Welcome to the Wealth Studying Podcast. This is episode 82. It's February 2nd, 2015. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. Here at the Wealth Studying Podcast, I try and teach you 10 wealth building principles to help you build not only your net worth, but more importantly, your personal freedom. If you're not familiar with my wealth building principles, go back and listen to the first 10 episodes of this podcast. That's where I lay out my philosophy and the foundation that I use to build my wealth going back over these nearly 30 years. Now, you won't hear me talk about any get-rich-quick schemes. It's just about hard work, earning more than you spend, and learning to become a successful investor. It's all about saving money so that you can eventually put that money to work for you so that your money works for you and you're not working for your money. Well, hey, I like to say that money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom. And if that's what you're interested in, then you've come to the right podcast. And in today's episode, I'm going to talk about inflation and deflation. These are terms that are widely used, but when you hear the way people talk about them, it's obvious that in many cases, they may not know what they're talking about. Now, this could be because the politicians or the people in the financial industry want to use doublespeak. They may just want to confuse you or obfuscate things. But there's a lot of hype that's going around about inflation and deflation. And I just wanted to set the record straight, at least from my understanding. Now, I'm going to explain this in a simple way, and I do that with all the wealth-studying principles, and that's because I'm a simple guy. Now, if you like really complex things, or you want to hear some new groundbreaking investment approach, you're probably not going to hear that from me. You see, I think the way that wealth is built today is not that much different than it was built 30 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. And it really does come down to some simple principles, and that's why I tell you about my 10 wealth building principles. Now, there are people that are trying to sell you things, and whether that's selling you something so that they can buy your vote so they can stay in political office, or whether it's selling you some type of a financial product that you really don't need or that's not going to benefit you. See, there's all kinds of people that are trying to take the money out of your wallet and put it into theirs. And one of the ways they do that is by using fancy terms, or by bending the definition of words that you may not understand. So that's why I want to talk about inflation and deflation today. I've got a lot of questions about it from people that I just run into in everyday life, as well as, you know, listeners to this podcast. I've been promising to get around to this topic, and so we're going to do that today. And as long as I don't forget, I am going to wrap up by explaining why we're not currently seeing hyperinflation. Many people thought we would have seen that over these last 7 or 8 years coming out of the recession, with all the money that's been printed, with all the easing from not only the United States government's deficit spending and debt borrowing, and then the Federal Reserve's printing of money. But then we also see governments all around the world doing the same thing. So I'll try and also answer the question of why aren't we seeing hyperinflation, because a lot of people are asking about that. And so we'll get started in just a minute. I do want to just make one quick comment on the stock market, and I promise this will be quick. Today was the first session for the new month, and if today is any indication of the way that February is going to go, then we'll see even more volatility this month than we did in January. The markets opened up, and then they dropped pretty quickly, and then they bounced back up, and then they bounced down, and then they bounced back up again, and they actually had a pretty strong finish. Now, the volume, although above average, looks like it was less than what we had in the previous session on Friday, so that's not as exceptional as it would have been had we have seen higher volume. But in any case, U.S. equities did finish strong today. The markets, or major markets, indexes like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, are still both below their 50-day moving average. So that's something you're going to want to watch. We'll see how things pan out here the rest of the week. But it has been extremely volatile. So be cautious. As far as my investments, I mentioned last week that I started to take some positions overseas. I did that through purchasing U.S.-based exchange-traded funds. Friday was not a good day for those. Just like U.S. equities, Friday was not a good day for the foreign markets. However, in a lot of cases, they more than made up for that today, so we had a really nice rebound on these overseas markets as well. Now again, will this continue through the week or in the upcoming months? Well, I have no idea. I am invested. I am watching it closely. I'll pull the plug if I have to, but I would love to see a nice little pop here the next couple weeks in some of these foreign markets. Now, I have no way of knowing, but for now, the way I'm interpreting the market, it looks to me, and this is just my personal opinion, I'm not offering advice or recommendations in any way, I'm just stating a personal opinion, it looks to me that there is some more value overseas than what we're seeing currently in the United States. The United States does have a very nice market. We do have better growth. I think overall we have much better opportunities than the overseas markets. However, All that is fully priced into the U.S. stock market. And because of the devaluation of other currencies, there may be some better opportunities overseas. And so that's why I've bought some positions in those markets. Like I said, though, we'll have to wait and see how it all pans out. Now let's get back into inflation deflation. So here's what you need to understand about inflation and deflation. Most of the time, people use the terms inflation and deflation to be synonymous with the fact that prices are rising and falling. And it's important that you don't confuse the two. You see, rising or falling prices may be as a result of inflation or deflation, but the rising and falling prices aren't the cause of inflation and deflation. In fact, rising and falling prices are basically caused by two factors. One of those factors is this commonly talked about inflation and deflation, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But the other reason for rising and falling prices has nothing to do with inflation and deflation. It has to do with supply and demand. Now, supply and demand is a basic economic principle. It's a very powerful economic principle. It's something that you should learn because it not only affects everyday prices, it affects what you pay for gasoline and milk and bread, but it also has a major impact on things like your earnings power. You see, your employer pays you based on the laws of supply and demand, those same laws of supply and demand that affect what you pay for bread or milk. And those same powerful laws of supply and demand are what drives the stock market. And so if you're having problems making money in the stock market or you don't understand the stock market, you should first start with understanding supply and demand. And then you'll be able to apply that to the stock market in terms of bid and asked price and the actual volume of trade, the actual amount of people that are participating in the trade in that stock market. Now, we're not going to get into a lot of detail in all that today. We cover that in previous podcasts, and we'll be talking about it in future ones as well. But it's just important for you to understand, supply and demand affects all things. It's part of that price discovery mechanism that I talked about a few episodes back when we talked about economics. Supply and demand is part of that invisible hand that regulates the economy. And I'm sure you know how it works, but let's just take it from the basics. If you have more supply than you have demand, then prices fall. Okay, more supply than demand means that if you were running a lemonade stand and you had 15 glasses of lemonade sitting out and they all had ice in them and they were ready to go and ready for people to purchase and you were selling them for 50 cents a glass, but you're sitting out at your lemonade stand on the corner of your street or at the end of your driveway and all day long cars are driving by you, and no one's stopping to buy a glass of lemonade. Well, see, you have more supply of lemonade than your local market is demanding, right? And it's that simple. It doesn't matter if you're talking about gasoline or gold or plutonium, whatever. Everything comes down to supply and demand, and it can be as simple as that illustration I just used with the lemonade stand. If you have more of something, whether it's a product or a service, if you have more of that than consumers want to buy or that they want to consume, then your prices are going to come down. Because if your prices don't come down, consumers won't buy them. They'll substitute other products or they'll do without. It's just a fact, and that's why we call it a law. Now, this oversupply, or the fact that you have a greater supply than demand, it can be for a number of reasons, right? It can just be because of consumer apathy. Maybe supply and demand were in equilibrium, but consumers just got tired of that product, or they just got tired of buying, or they wanted to stay home that evening and not go out to dinner. Or it could be that the fad is just over, right? Nobody wants Beanie Babies. It could also be because of overcapacity of production. And that's one of the problems that our whole global economy is seeing right now. There's a lot of factories making a lot of things that nobody wants. This is primarily because of the explosive growth and the malinvestment in China. Again, we're not going to get into that in this podcast, but that is a fact. There's a lot of things being made right now because of malinvestment, because factories were built in anticipation of consumer demand, and they were funded because credit was cheap and capital was readily available. But now that those factories are built, nobody wants the products that are coming out of them. Okay, so that's just a straight case of overcapacity. Now, there can also be falling prices because of oversupply, just because of technological advances. And this is what we see in the electronics industry. We've seen it for the last, 60 years, 70 years. Every year there's advances in technology. And so electronics, whether it's consumer electronics or military electronics or aerospace electronics, any type of electronics, every year they get smaller and they get better, right? Whether it's a transistor radio or whether it's the Intel chip in your computer or whether it's some type of sensor that's in your smartphone, because we've had so many technological advances and because we keep making these advances when it comes to electronics, we can make things faster, smaller, we can make more of them, and so consequently, there's always more than enough supply to keep up with the demand. And the supply is so good that companies like Apple can come out and invent products before there's even any demand. They invent things that we don't even know we need. Now, they market these products to us, and sure, we buy them, and just because the price comes down, it doesn't mean it's necessarily cheap. But when you look at something like a smartphone today or some other piece of electronic device that you just simply have to have that 10 years ago you didn't have because it didn't exist, well, maybe you're paying $200 or $300 or $500 for that item today. But to get something that was remotely comparable 10 years ago, right, it would have cost you maybe $1,000. Now, things like computing power, maybe they don't seem cheap to you because you're still paying several hundred dollars for them, but think in comparison of what that same kind of computing power would have cost you 10 years ago or 100 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, we would have been doing it with very slow, you know, rudimentary desktop computers. Now, at the time, we thought they were revolutionary, but I mean, you compare a desktop computer today to what it was 10 years ago, and you know, the thing 10 years ago just doesn't even compare. And then you go back 100 years ago, and all that computation, it had to be done by people. Shoot, I mean, you don't have to go back 100 years ago. You just go back to when I was a kid. At that time, in the 1960s, if you went to an aerospace company or some type of an engineering company, you would have seen them employ thousands of engineers, if not tens of thousands of engineers. Now, these were men in white short-sleeved shirts with pocket protectors and slide rules, and it took thousands or 10,000s of these very brilliant men to make computations, to figure out how to build bridges and skyscrapers and put men on the moon. Well, today, your smartphone can do more calculations than those thousands or 10,000s of brilliant engineers could do. You see, that's how supply and demand works. So sometimes it's because of overcapacity, because of malinvestment, or somebody made a mistake. They built a factory to make products, but then they realize they can't sell them, so they have to lower the price. Or it's because consumer tastes change, or because consumers are fickle, or because fads come and go, or it could be, like I mentioned, because of technological advances. But you can take this to the bank. Every time there's more supply than there is demand, prices will come down. Now, the corollary to that is when demand is higher than supply. And you guessed it. Whenever your demand is stronger than your supply, then prices will go up. And that's because consumers are willing to pay for something that's scarce. And remember, in previous podcasts, we talked about economics, where economics is really just the management of scarcity. And so that's how the price discovery mechanism, this law of supply and demand, really filter their way through the economy, and that's why you have the invisible hand that seems to regulate everything in the economy. If there are a lot of consumers and they want a particular product or service, and there isn't enough to go around, then the price will naturally go up because they're going to be willing to part with their hard-earned dollars to buy that product or service because they want it. And it doesn't matter why they want it. Maybe they want it because they want to be popular. Maybe they want it because it's just a fad. Maybe they want it because their child's sick and they need to buy the medicine. Maybe they want it because they're hungry and it's a food product and it satisfies their hunger desires. Or maybe they're addicted to something. Again, it doesn't matter. As long as demand is stronger than supply, the price will always go up. So there you have it. There's supply and demand, and that's one of the set of factors that affect rising and falling prices. Now, here's the other thing, and this is inflation and deflation. Now, these are more complicated because while supply and demand is a natural law, it's just a function of the way a free market works. And because it is just a basic function of the way markets work, it's fairly easy to understand. Inflation and deflation, on the other hand, is something that's man-made. It's something that's created. It's actually artificial. Now, it happens every day, and it's so much a part of our life that we take it for granted that it's natural, but it really isn't. It's artificial. It's all man-made. And when I say man-made, I mean it's created by the government or by the central banks or by other forms of banks or lending institutions, because in its purest sense, inflation and deflation has everything to do about the supply of money. Now remember, when I talked about the natural laws of supply and demand, that occurred because of balances or imbalances of the supply of a particular product or service and how that related to the demand from a consumer. When we talk about inflation and deflation, the fact that those prices increase or decrease have everything to do with the supply of money. Now, this is an important point, and it's a simple point, but it's often overlooked. So let's step back a minute and remember what I talked about with supply and demand. In supply and demand, the prices rose or fell based on the relationship between the supply of products and services and the demand that the consumer had for those products and services. Now, when prices rise or fall because of increases or decreases in the monetary supply, in the supply of money, and these are inflationary or deflationary forces, it has nothing to do with the supply of products. It's about the money supply. And this is why it's artificially created, because who creates money? Human institutions, bankers, credit cards, mortgage lenders. See, these are the people that create the money supply. And this is a very different type of process than when we talked about supply and demand as it related to products and services. Now, I know some of you are probably confused and I might not be explaining this as good as I could, so let me give you some examples. If you have an increased money supply, and that might be because the government or the central bank literally went out and printed money. You say there used to be, $10 billion in circulation, and they go out and they make $20 billion in circulation. So they double the supply of money. Now, in the old days, this literally was done by printing or by debasing coins. You take a silver coin and you take, say, maybe 25 or 50% of the silver out and you fill the rest up with lead, and then you could make more coins. And you'd pass them off as if they were 100% silver, but they're not. They're filled with lead. And then we got the printing presses, and they'd print bills out. And then when the government needed more money, they'd just run the printing presses and print more money. Well, we really don't necessarily, quote, print money anymore. It's all done digitally, and it's mostly done now with the way they manipulate interest rates and the way the central banks buy government debt. And unfortunately, now they've even gone to buying private debt. But that's how, in modern times, they increase the money supply, from the government or from the central bank standpoint. The other way is just through banks in general. When you go down to your local bank or credit union and you borrow money to buy a car or for a mortgage on your home, that's creating money. You see, you didn't have the money to buy it to begin with. And so the mortgage loan or the loan for your car, that's injecting new capital, new money into the marketplace. It's giving you money that really didn't exist before, because we use fractional banking. It isn't that they went into their vault and pulled $10,000 out and gave it to you. This is money that really didn't exist, and they give it to you and you go out and spend it. So that was an increase in the money supply. You're spending money that really doesn't exist. Same thing with credit cards. You get applications for 10 credit cards in the mail. You fill them all out. Each of them gives you $10,000 credit limit. Well, now you can go out and you can spend money that previously didn't exist. So the money supply can be created in a number of ways, whether it's literally printing of money, whether it's debasement of money, whether it's central banks manipulating interest rates or buying government debt, or whether it's simply borrowing money from a bank. And that borrowing can be you when you borrow it for your mortgage, or your neighbor when they borrow it for a car. Or it can just be the federal government or the state government when they go out and do deficit spending. That's when they spend more than they're bringing in with taxpayer receipts. They spend more than that, and so consequently they have to borrow that difference from the banks. So debt is an increase of the money supply. Now let's think about our law of supply and demand. What happens when a consumer has more money today than they had yesterday? And it doesn't matter whether they worked to get that money or whether they borrowed it or whether they inherited it. But just imagine a consumer that has more money today than he had yesterday. That's an increase in his personal money supply. And what's he going to do? Well, most likely he's going to spend it. So if you get a raise at work, or you inherit a large sum of money from a relative, or you win the lottery, your personal money supply goes up and you buy bigger and better things. You trade in your Chevy and you buy a Mercedes. You move out of your two-bedroom house and you buy a McMansion. Now, this consumerism isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's good that consumers have money and they want to buy better things. They want nicer homes. They want to be able to provide their children with better education. They want more recreational opportunities. They want to be warm in the winter and cool in the summer, right? Mankind doesn't want to live in a cave. There's nothing wrong with this. This is what we call progress. The problem is that when either individuals or institutions like governments borrow money, and in particular borrow money in excess that they may never pay back, that's where we get too much of an increase in the monetary supply. That's when the money supply is increased, and that's why we have inflation. And again, it can be created by central banks or it can be created by credit cards. It doesn't really matter how it's created. And you know this works. You know that if you walked into a store and you only had $10 in your pocket, and that's all you had, and you didn't have a credit card, or you couldn't put something on layaway, or you couldn't get an IOU from someone, then whenever you walked into a store, the most you could ever spend would be $10, because that's all you have in your wallet. And because you have other responsibilities, you have to pay your electric bill, you have to buy gasoline for your car so you can get to work, you have to buy food so that you can eat. I mean, all that's got to come out of your $10. So when you walk into a store, say a department store to buy some clothes or something, if you only have $10 in your wallet, the most you're ever going to walk out of that store with is $10 in merchandise. But again, because you have these other responsibilities, food, fuel, housing, that $10 has to go to pay that as well. So you're not even going to walk out of there with $10 in merchandise. Maybe you're only going to have a dollar or two to spend. That's your disposable income. And so if all you had was that hard currency in your wallet to spend, then you would spend less. You wouldn't have to have as much fiscal discipline if there weren't things like credit cards or payday loans or easy mortgages and all these low interest rates. You see, you wouldn't need the discipline because if you only had a few dollars in your pocket, no one's going to give you the merchandise because you don't have anything to pay for it. But in our society today, because there's such an oversupply of the monetary system, starting at the federal banks and going all the way down to the local credit union and credit card companies, because there's just so much availability of cheap credit that it doesn't matter that someone only has a few dollars in their pocket, because if they have a credit card, they can run up their credit card bill. And so consequently, they can buy things that ordinarily they wouldn't be able to buy. So what happens? So in my example, the money supply has been increased, and since there's more money, consumers feel like they can spend more, and what it creates is really a false or a fake demand. And what happens when you have increased demand, but you didn't have any corresponding increase in the supply of products or services? Because remember, you didn't get more products or services, you just created more fake money. So with this excess money, the consumer has excess demand, they go out and they use that money to bid up the price on these scarce products and services. And that's why prices go up when you increase the monetary supply. And again, it doesn't matter how you do it, whether you literally print money as a government, or whether you have deficit spending, or whether you're borrowing money on credit cards, or for a car loan, or for a mortgage. And if you dispute that this is the way it works, just think about it. Imagine if you couldn't get a car loan or a loan for a mortgage on a home. Imagine if you had to pay cash for it. Would you be driving the car that you're driving now? Would you be living in the house that you were living in now? Most people wouldn't be. Most people don't have that kind of cash, and that's why they get loans. And it's the ability for them to get loans that creates more demand, and that's what raises prices. If you had to go out and buy your car with the cash that you had available, would you be driving a $30,000 or a $50,000 or $40,000 car? No, you'd probably be driving a car for about $2,000. You see, that's the way it works. That's how an increase in the monetary supply drives up the price of products. Companies can afford to make $50,000 luxury and sports cars because they know that the consumers that they're selling them to don't have to come down there with cash. They come into the showroom and they say, oh, but it's only $432 a month. You can afford it. And so that's how cars are sold. Zero down. No interest. Pay the principal only. And as a result, consumers end up spending more on their transportation than they would otherwise if they had to pay with cash. Now, deflation works the same way, but just the opposite. Deflation occurs because of a decrease in the monetary supply. There's less money in the system. And again, this works just in opposite to an oversupply of the money system. Whether it's the government or a central bank or whether it's a credit card company, they just offer less credit or they raise interest rates or they make their lending policies more strict. So if they tighten up lending policies on a mortgage, for example, they raise the limit of your income. Or they tell you have to have 20 or 25% of a down payment. Or they tell you that instead of your interest payment only being 3%, it's 15%. You see, these are all ways that you restrict credit or that you consequently reduce the money supply. And what happens when there's less money? Well, prices come down because it affects demand. Remember, if all you had was $10 in your pocket and you walked into a department store, you're not going to come out of there with a $200 pair of jeans. You're not going to come out of there with $150 sunglasses because all you have is $10 to spend. You can't put it on a credit card. You can't lay it away. You can't get something today that you're going to pay for tomorrow because they're only going to accept cash. And so therefore, prices will come down because there'll be less of a demand. Do you see how that works? Now, the reason this is so important is because, again, people in the financial industry that are trying to sell you something or politicians that are trying to manipulate you and get you to vote for them, they're manipulating the money supply, and for the most part, they're creating inflation. Inflation is a hidden tax. It steals from you without you even knowing it. Right now, our Federal Reserve, they're trying to target an inflation rate of 2% a year. Now, right now, I think it's running about 1.5 or 1.8, and they're upset about that. You see, they're in the banking business. They're in the financial business where they like to devalue the money. They like to create inflation, as does the government, because it steals from you. Now, 2% inflation sounds very innocuous, and you often hear me say, well, hey, I'm not worried about it because the inflation rate's only 2%. But that's a way we're conditioned to believe. You see, 2% means that basically in one generation, over your working career, they'll have stolen half your wealth from you. You see, at a 2% inflation rate, that means that in 36 years, your money today in today's dollars is only going to be able to buy half of what it buys today. So let's say you're in your mid-20s and you're making $50,000 a year. And over the next 36 years, you keep getting raises at work and you get promoted and things like that. But it just never seems like you have enough money. It seems like your bills just keep growing at the same rate or faster than your pay increases do. And that's because of that inflation. And again, even if it's only 2% inflation, over 36 years, you're going to lose half your buying power. So when you're in your mid-20s and you're making $50,000, and 36 years later, you're ready to retire, you're in your 60s, and you're making $100,000, and you're thinking, well, I'm making twice what I made, 30-some years ago, but it still seems like I don't have any money. And that's because you don't. That's because in 36 years, your $100,000 buys what your $50,000 used to buy. The unfortunate thing is that most people don't recognize this. They don't know that they're being ripped off. It's very insidious. It's a hidden tax. In the mid-1950s, now I wasn't born yet, but this is a story that I'll tell you about my father. In about 1955, my father was leading a very nice middle-class lifestyle. He was a poor kid that did well for himself, and although he was still very young at that time, he had managed to go out and get himself, a nice brick house in the suburbs. He had a new car. He just had a really nice 1955 middle-class lifestyle. And you know what? You know how much money he made? Well, he's long passed on, and I can't ask him, but I remember asking my mother one time a few years ago how much my dad would have made back then. Now, she said she wasn't sure, but between the mid-1950s and, say, 1960, she's sure that he never made more than $5,000. He might have made maybe like $4,500 a year. Now, can you imagine living a middle-class lifestyle, a very comfortable, upwardly mobile middle-class lifestyle on less than $5,000 a year? But that was possible in 1955. So in two generations, that's the amount of wealth that's been wiped out. My older children are about the age that my father would have been in the mid-1950s when he bought his first home. My dad bought a very nice home for, somewhere around maybe $18,000. Okay, so let's think about this in today's terms. Do you think that my 26-year-old son can go out with $18,000 and buy anything to live in? You couldn't buy a used RV for $18,000 to live in. Nothing would even come close to comparing to the very nice brick 3-bedroom home that my father bought for about $18,000. And that's just two generations away. That's how much your money has devaluated in 60 years. My children, to have an equal lifestyle, would certainly have to be making at least $100,000, maybe $150,000. But my dad could do it on $5,000. That's the insidious nature of increasing the monetary supply and consequently what happens with inflation. That's how it steals from you. Now, I took more time than I wanted to in this explanation. I get passionate about this stuff, so you have to forgive me. I'm not going to have enough time to explain why we're not seeing the hyperinflation that many people thought we should be seeing because of all this central bank interaction and intervention in the economy, especially in these last 7 or 8 years since the Great Recession of 2008. So I'll come back in another podcast and I'll talk about that. Won't necessarily be tomorrow, but I promise I will get back to that topic, and we'll talk about why we're not seeing hyperinflation. Well, again, I want to welcome all of our new listeners. I especially want to thank those of you that have gone out to iTunes and subscribed or have taken the time to give the show a rating or a review. I really appreciate that. That helps us build a wealth-steading community. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can reach me through the website, which is wealthsteading.com. As always, until the next episode, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.